I'm Christopher Lydon, and this is The Whole Wide World. Chris Hedges of The New York Times spent 15 years reporting wars in Central America, the Balkans, and the Middle East. What he discovered was not the big truth, but the big lie about war, that there is lasting good and glory in it for men and nations.
You know, killing human beings is not as it's presented to us, either by the press or by the entertainment industry. Killing human beings is often much more akin to slaughtering animals. It's very messy. It often takes a long time. It's dirty. It's disgusting. It's unsettling. And you find in firefights, when you finish a firefight, one of the first things you begin to do is create a narrative in your head. How am I going to explain this? How am I going to turn this event where I spent all of my time in terror trying to figure out what was happening into a story? And that is probably the inception of myth. You see it in Troilus and Cressida in Shakespeare, where he has Achilles kill Hector. Hector's unarmed. He's surrounded in Shakespeare by 300 Myrmidon soldiers who thrust their spears into Hector. It's murder, and I think that's the other thing. Murder is always part of war. Murder is an integral part of war, and murder of innocents is an integral part of war. And after Hector is killed, Achilles turns to the Myrmidons and tells them to, you know, go on the battlefield and save the, you know, Hector, the mighty Achilles, is slain. At that very, it's that very instant in which you create heroic myth. You create a false narrative. And it's that false narrative that's fundamental to the selling or packaging of war.
The title of the Chris Hedges book last year summed it up in a sentence. War is a force that gives us meaning. That force is a compound of fear, hysteria, intoxication, tribal nationalism, and madness. So powerful a force that in ancient times, Greeks and Romans honored war with the name of a god, Ares or Mars, still a power to contend with. Chris Hedges, you write that the first Gulf War in 1991 made war fashionable again. What did you mean by that?
At the end of the Vietnam War, at the end of our defeat, we became a better nation. We asked questions about ourselves that we had not asked before. We were forced to confront our own capacity for evil and atrocity. We were humbled and probably even humiliated. We struggled to see ourselves as the outsider saw us, and what we saw was not particularly flattering. We knew the cost of war and the danger of war, what it did not only to others, but what it did to ourselves. Freud writes in Civilization and Its Discontents that life is a battle between the forces of love, of eros, to preserve and conserve and protect, and the forces of death, thanatos, those forces that seek to destroy other living things and ourselves. And that life is, within the individual and within societies, a constant battle between these two forces. And for this reason, Freud believed that war would never be eradicated. Always for Freud, one of these forces was ascendant. I think after the Vietnam War, the forces of Eros were ascendant. But gradually, we again began to court death. We did this during the Reagan years when we used, you know, the preponderance of military force to invade Grenada, Panama.
Nicaragua.
Yeah. And by the time the Persian Gulf War arrived, we were ready again to restore war's good name, to revel in our own military prowess and strength. And the military, with the complete connivance of the press, presented to us a mythic narrative of our own greatness. There was no death. Death was, you know, those who died were nameless, faceless phantoms, especially, of course, the tens of thousands of Iraqi civilians. It was presented, war was presented quite effectively as a form of entertainment, video clips, Sidewinder missiles. Those abstract notions of patriotism, of glory, of heroism, things that allowed us to stop thinking and just revel in ourselves, were dished up, you know, hour by hour on CNN. And one must remember that the media is a business, and mythic narratives of war boost ratings and sell newspapers. They have since the Crimean War, when the modern war correspondent was invented.
Detachment is perhaps the war reporter's toughest trick, to cover the battle and see beyond it.
You know, you saw this in Bosnia. I mean, I covered the war in Bosnia, and I wasn't a Serb, a Croat, or a Muslim, so I covered it for what it was, which was disgusting human slaughter. And in the war in Bosnia, as in many wars, it was primarily the slaughter of innocents. But if I was a Serb, I would cover it through that mythic narrative. And I would have looked at the war, as people in Belgrade did, very differently. I would have gone into the town and I would have first found that brave Serb soldier who's a hero. Then I would have found that trapped Serb family in the village who waited to be saved by the gallant Serb militia that came into the town. And then I would have interviewed Serb refugees about the terrible atrocities by the evil Muslims or Croats. And you don't report outside of that narrative. And if you do, you don't get published. I mean, it's why, you know, that's why you have on TV these newscasters with their flag, you know, lapel pins, and Dan Rather saying, you know, where do I sign up? And the mass media, especially the electronic media, loves this stuff and eats it up. And wait till the war starts. Wait till we start getting, you know, hour by hour coverage. There's a kind of brainwashing that goes in. I mean, it's very hard to think. You can't think. You're just bombarded with it night and day.
That's the war high, which, as Chris Hedges observes, plunges into a pit of amnesia, confusion, and despair when the killing stops.
I remember interviewing Serb soldiers who had taken part in the massacres in Srebrenica. And maybe remorse is too strong a word, but certainly very deep disquiet over what they had done. Yet I know from having been in those situations that caught up in that frenzy of destruction, in that high of being able to revoke another person's charter to live on this planet, they felt godlike. They felt or believed that they felt the power of the divine, that power to turn human beings into objects, either to gratify or destroy or both. It is a sad and frightening fact that crowds of human beings like to destroy, and there is a perverse and powerful thrill that comes with that destruction. When you see units like that on a rampage, their eyes are glazed over. They can hardly speak. They mutter gibberish. It is as if they're on drugs. And indeed, I think ultimately war is probably best definable as a drug, and perhaps the most powerful narcotic invented by humankind.
Do we know how to recognize the symptoms of our own nationalism, the warnings?
No. I think that you know, a couple weeks after 9/11, I woke up and thought we'd all become the Serbs. That's what scares me.
Really?
That you have to recognize the symptoms of the disease in order to fight it. But it must be probed and understood and guarded against in a conscious way. And if it's not, the mass contagion takes over.
Talk about the symptoms, the sort of the spots that you recognized in our own world after 9/11.
The dichotomy of the world between them and us, the exaltation of ourself, the euphoria that comes with a sense of belonging. You know, you walk out your apartment door in New York and that neighbor who you haven't been able to stand for years suddenly becomes your brother. You go down the aisles of the supermarket, instead of everyone averting your gaze, they look at you because we're all together in this. We're all one. We're comrades. And that's, I think, what people seek to recreate once war is over, because, of course, once that external threat is gone, you can't sustain this. And it's this kind of ecstatic glow that is one of the many highs of war and one of war's attractions. We have a sense of belonging that we didn't have before. And that's very hard to fight, even for intellectuals, even for social critics, because one can be leveled. Everybody can be in this together. Everybody can join the club. And to stand outside the club is to refuse the high. Not only to refuse the high, but to be hoisted and tacked onto a cross of your own creation. And it's painful, and it's lonely. You have no one to talk to. You're reviled. It's very, very difficult to fight against this tide.
Are you suffering from it? Have people made your life hard because of this book at this time?
In the event of another catastrophic terrorist attack and in the midst of a war, this kind of stuff is going to be pretty unpalatable to a lot of people. It's certainly going to be interpreted, I'm sure, as unpatriotic. But that's fine, because I think patriotism is dangerous, both in others and in ourselves.
Count them up. We've heard 6 arguments in this hour about what drives war in this globalizing moment of 2003. A clash of civilizations, perhaps? A cultural crisis? Oil? Democracy? Overreaching empire? Or some deeper human perversity? 6 rationales for war are enough for one museum tour, enough for an hour of radio, but doesn't it sound in the end like too many excuses, or too few, for a real killing contest, without even mentioning the alternatives to war, or counting the cost of war and the innocents who will pay it? Finally, the Irish and global poet Seamus Heaney reminds us to remember in the body counts the single death. Heaney is drawn back these days to the poetry and the slaughter of World War I, and in particular to the war poet Wilfred Owen.
There's a little poem called Futility. It's about a casualty. It comes right down to the single death. And that's what I guess we have to attend to, single death. Move him into the sun. Gently its touch awoke him once, at home, whispering of fields unsown. Always it woke him, even in France, until this morning and this snow. If anything might rouse him now, the kind old sun will know. Think how it wakes the seeds, woke once the clays of a cold star. Our limbs so dear achieved, our sides full nerved, still warm, too hard to stir. Was it for this the clay grew tall? Oh, what made fatuous sunbeams toil to break earth's sleep at all?
Please visit our global community online at thewholewideworld.net. The Whole Wide World is a collaboration of Leiden and McGrath Productions and the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School, in association with WGBH Radio Boston. We had help from producers Ben Walker and Catherine Bidwell, from engineer Tom Tiger and Jake Shapiro of the Public Radio Exchange, Jay Allison of transim.org, with support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, is our radio visionary. Thanks also to Keith Kaya Wilson, Justin Grotlucian, Keisha Parsons, Josh Ward, the Christian Science Publishing Society, and public radio stations WCAI and WNAN on Cape Cod. Support for this program is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon.
PRI, Public Radio International.